what we've got tonight is a debate between the Socialist Party of Great Britain and the Socialist Workers' Party on the question of, after the miners' strike, which way forward for socialists. The format of the evening will be, firstly, Steve Coleman of the Socialist Party will speak for 25 minutes. That will be followed by Connie Tipton of the Socialist Workers' Party for 25 minutes. We'll have a brief interval where you sort of get a drink, etc., come back in, then we'll throw it over to questions and discussions, which is probably the most important part of the meeting. So we hope that you'll push the speakers to explain their points further at that stage. Right, I think that will do. I'll come on to Steve Coleman.
Thank you, Comrade Chairman, comrades and friends. Nearly 100 years ago, in 1887, there was a major miners' strike in Britain. It was the biggest of the miners' strikes that took place at the end of the last century during the crisis. The whole of Lanarkshire came out, Scottish minefields were put to a stop, Northumberland came out, the northeast of England was facing its biggest industrial crisis ever. And it was to be a long struggle, it was a bitter strike against the parasites who owned the mines in the northeast of England and in Scotland. And as usual, when there's a strike, there was no shortage of pious support and radical sloganising offered to the workers by those who thought that capitalism ought to be made fair. People who thought that the miners deserved a fair wage, people who thought that the miners would have their grievances remedied if only the mines were nationalised and put in the hands of the state, people who wanted to bring a bit of fairness into the capitalist world, all assembled around this great strike and did their best to support it. And in April of that year, 1887, William Morris went up to Newcastle to address the striking miners, and William Morris was a speaker for the Socialist League, and he was a revolutionary. They'd never had anything like it in the whole of the northeast of England, in all of the rallies during the miners' strike of 1887, because William Morris was not prepared to gas the ritualistic slogans about "We're behind you, brothers," and "You can win within capitalism." William Morris told the miners what every revolutionary always says in every strike situation: the wages system cannot be made fair. You cannot humanise capitalism. You cannot have any real and lasting victory as long as you are being robbed by the wages system, which is bound at all times to leave you without dignity, without fairness, without happiness. And I want to quote from the speech that William Morris made in front of 2,000 miners at that rally in Newcastle in 1887, because I want to show you it's happened before. History has repeated itself. It was reported in the Newcastle Chronicle on the 11th of April 1887, and if any of you have a chance to read it in full, it was a magnificent speech. William Morris said, "Their struggle was for a position in which they would be able to live a life which people called tolerable. He did not call the life of a working man under the present system a tolerable life at all. When they had gained all that was possible under the present system, they would still not have the life that human beings ought to have. What was their life at the best? They worked hard, day in, day out, without any sort of hope whatever. Their work was to work to live in order that they might live to work." Now, Morris was saying there precisely what socialists must always do. He looked beyond the immediate struggle for the crumbs within capitalism, which are created by the working class who create the whole of the cake. He looked beyond it and he said, the real struggle has to be not for the right to be employed, not for the right to have security as a wage slave, but for the freedom to live creatively, to work in a society that you own and control. Now, Morris put the case then that I put tonight for the abolition of the wages system. Now, I've been told in the past by so-called socialists who I've met, and you meet so-called socialists in all kinds of places, and we argue with one another, rather like a scene out of The Life of Brian, about which one is the real socialist and which one is really on the right road and who got the dots and the commas in Marx right. But they say, look, you can't go around the working class advocating the abolition of the wages system. I mean, you go and tell them that on a picket line or at a strike committee meeting, that what you really ought to be doing is fighting to get rid of the whole system that makes you a wage slave. You'll be laughed at. People will say you're mad. And this, of course, is the view of the Socialist Workers' Party. You don't go around talking to workers about ending wage slavery, because if you do, people will think you're mad. And this, indeed, is why the SWP is a political party which is eminently sane. It is one of the most sane political parties which has ever had the audacity to call itself revolutionary. It's so sane that when it goes along to a picket line or to a strike meeting, it parrots all of the demands that workers are making. It says, you want higher wages? Well, that is what you've got to concentrate on. You want to end pit closures? That's the victory we've got to go for. We demand that there shall be no pit closures. That was the slogan which the SWP had on its banners throughout the 84-85 miners' strike. They come along and say, you want the right to get a job, to be exploited, to be a wage slave? That's what we'll do. And on their banners in the 70s, the Socialist Workers' Party said, demand the right to work, demand the right to become a wage slave, to be exploited by someone else. And like in 1887, in 1985, the miners' strike ended in defeat, because the system was greater, as it always is greater, than the sentiments and the demands which challenge it. As long as those sentiments and those demands are entrenched within the rut of capitalism. And this is what always happens in a capitalist system. You cannot expect capitalists whose function in society is to legally rob the working class for profit to say, we'll ignore the dictatorship of profit and will bow to the requirements of human needs. So, let me make it clear at the outset that the future does not lie in the direction of what appears to be sane and reasonable and realistic. People who think that that's where the future lies, people who think that you have to tag on to the prejudices and to the apparent, inevitable realities of capitalism in order to build a movement to transform society. They are, in fact, the people who are buried in the past. If you're a socialist, you have to put forward ideas which may, perhaps immediately, meet with the questioning and the doubt of workers who you meet. And if it means that there's a revolutionary, people occasionally turn round to you, as they often do to me, and say you're stark raving mad, then you should be checking your socialist credentials when workers never say that to you. Because when workers stop telling you that you're a little bit mad, when workers persist in telling you that you are in fact accepting the same kind of ideas that capitalism has conditioned them to want, then you're not, of course, offering something new. You're tagging on to the past. Now, I want to make three basic criticisms of my opponent's party, and in so doing, I want to defend the position of the Socialist Party. I'm not criticising my opponent because he's not a good enough socialist or because he's not a concerned enough revolutionary. I wouldn't waste my time doing that. I'm opposing him and his party because I would argue that they are not socialists and that they are not revolutionaries. And we have to look logically and clearly at the evidence for that claim. The first criticism which I put to my opponent is that his party spreads illusions about what can be done within capitalism. Let's be clear. Under capitalism, goods and services are produced for sale on the market with a view to profit. They're not produced for use. They're not produced so that human requirements can be satisfied. They are produced primarily for profit, and if there's no profit, then there is no production. And that's why, as millions of people starve, they're surrounded by rotting food. As tens of thousands die of the cold every winter, coal mines have to be shut because it's not profitable to keep them open. That is the economic law of capitalism, and it is an unavoidable economic law within capitalism. But my opponent's party is repeatedly demanding of the capitalists that they ignore the iron law of profit. At the moment, there are something like 4 million unemployed workers in Britain, millions more across the world. These are useful people who want to work. They want to produce useful things. But the capitalist class, quite rightly, in accordance with their class interests, say, we are not going to employ you. There's no profit in you. We're not going to exploit you. Again, when the British state says that we're going to decimate the coal mining industry, there's not enough profit in it, why should capitalists have to subsidise it to keep it going? That is perfectly right and logical and rational within the terms of the law of the capitalist system. And it is folly in the extreme to demand of the capitalists that they continue being the master class in capitalism, but they allow profits to bow to needs. And that is why last October, when Margaret Thatcher was being interviewed on BBC Radio by one of her fellow members of the Tory intelligentsia, Jimmy Young, she said, and I quote, "Uneconomic pits have always had to be closed, have always been closed, and must always be closed." And indeed, after a year of struggle, she demonstrated, as a Labour government would have demonstrated, as any government of capitalism will demonstrate, that that is precisely what the economic law of profit says. Now, there are two reasons why the Socialist Workers' Party may advocate these tactics for trying to deal with the problems of capitalism which expect the law of profit to be ignored. One of them is that quite possibly they simply don't understand capitalism. Like the Bishop of Durham, they're sort of compelled by a mixture of naive goodwill and utter economic ignorance. And therefore, they look at the system and they say, this is the way it should be. This is what we expect of capitalism. Therefore, why isn't it happening that way? And without doubt, that explains why many people on the left wing of capitalism are putting forward utopian demands for the system. Demands which are ultimately condemned to the dustbins of the stock exchange, which is where the power really matters. But the second and more pernicious reason that the Socialist Workers' Party adopts this futile tactic of telling workers to demand the impossible within capitalism is that it is argued that by showing workers what cannot be achieved, by telling workers to devote their energies and their passions towards aims which cannot be realised, workers are going to find out. It's like putting a group of school kids on the edge of a cliff, leaving them there to play, and when they come out of the intensive care unit, you say, well, there you are. You've learnt the lesson the hard way. Now we're going to play ice skating on the motorway, and you'll learn that lesson as well. And this is the repeated argument that's put forward by those who think that they can lead people into an education of their class position by telling them to do what can't be done. The thousands of workers who marched along behind the so-called right to work campaign, who thought that they were demanding and were going to get, if there was enough energy and passion, the opportunity to do useful work. The total failure of that campaign hasn't led them into learning the lessons. It's led thousands of them into bitter disillusion and into a feeling of cynicism towards politics and towards those who call themselves socialists. So let's be clear that the way forward for socialists has to begin with an understanding of what the capitalist system is and an honesty, and sometimes it's a very painful honesty, about what can and what cannot be achieved within it. And therefore, you say to workers that you've got a simple choice. Either you persist in attempting to run the wages system in the interest of wage slaves, either you try to organise the slaughterhouse in the interest of the cattle, or alternatively, you dismiss this whole project and you organise consciously for the socialist alternative. But this brings me to the next criticism I have to make of my opponent's party, that one searches in vain to find out what they mean by socialism, what socialism actually means in the vocabulary of the Socialist Workers' Party. They argue, quite correctly, I would have no disagreement, that Russia and its empire is not socialist. They can't be faulted on that at all. They argue China isn't socialist. Cuba isn't socialist. Albania isn't socialist. One can have no disagreement with that, even if I find it absurd in the extreme that the position of the Socialist Workers' Party is that Russia was socialist up until 1929. And then it performed the greatest ever leap back through social evolution known in history. It was socialist, and then it turned capitalist again. We're all sitting in capitalism waiting for socialism, but apparently the Russian workers went to bed in 1928. They got up on New Year's morning, looked around, they said, "Well, blow me, Ivan, capitalism's come." What nonsense. And according to Tony Cliff, it's all because Stalin was in charge instead of Trotsky. But for a party which has so much to say about socialism, it's quite mystifying that you read through many copies of Socialist Worker, "I've done this," and they never tell you what this socialism is that we should be arguing for. For example, in Socialist Worker, there's a column called "Where We Stand." Now you would think, well, that's a column to turn to. Read it. I doubt whether half the SWPers here have read it. Read the column called "Where We Stand." What does it tell you about socialism? Does it explain in any way the basic differences between capitalism and socialism? Does it say that in a socialist society, the means of living, the factories, the mines, the farms, the offices, the media, will be the common ownership of all people, not of a state or of individual capitalists? Does it explain that socialism will be a democratic world community where there will be no state and a group of people who, not being part of the government, are the governed and oppressed? No leaders or led. Does it explain that socialism is a society where everything will of necessity be available on the basis of free access to wealth? Because where you have common ownership, where the wealth of the world is owned in common, then everyone has free access to everything in a moneyless society. I see the SWP at the bookstalls embarrassed by this. This is an education class as well as a debate. Does it explain in Socialist Worker that it will be a society in which labour will be voluntary and cooperative on the basis of the principle "from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs"? That it will be a wageless society Not a word about it. You can read copy after copy of Socialist Worker. Not a word about a moneyless society. Not a word about a wageless society. Not a word about a stateless society. You just don't find it. Look at the literature. Attend the meetings of the Socialist Party. See what we have to say. Look at the clear socialist alternative we present. I put it to my opponent. I defy him when he stands up. Present us with a single statement in the literature of what is meant to be a socialist party, which tells us about socialism. But this debate is about the way forward for socialists. And if you're a socialist, what is the way forward? The way forward is to socialism. You've got to know what it is in order to be able to pursue the discussion about direction. If I tell my opponent, for example, that we're in Guildford at the moment and I want to get to Glasgow, it's not going to be any good for me to say, well, the way we'll do it is that I'll take a trip up to Aberdeen and then I'll go to Edinburgh and then I'll go to Dundee and maybe eventually, when I tried all of the wrong roads, when experience has taught me the lessons of my folly, I may perhaps end up in Glasgow. It's not the way to do it. The Socialist Workers' Party says to workers, vote for the Labour Party. I have in front of me the latest issue of Socialist Worker, a magnificent document, an exemplary statement of crass stupidity in a letter to the militant tendency where it says, our attitude is clear. We are for a Labour government. It goes on. We believe a future Labour government will not act in the interest of the working class. On the contrary, it will act like every previous Labour government in the interest of the bosses' class. I repeat the first sentence. Our attitude is clear. It's clearly absurd to advocate that people vote for a government that is against their class interest. But of course, you have to remember the tactic, and the tactic is that you've got to let workers go down every wrong avenue before they discover the wisdom of following the Socialist Workers' Party as a vanguard. Now, I'll tell you what socialists have to argue in relation to the socialist alternative. We have to go to workers when there's a strike, as we do. We have to go to workers when they're in the street or the pubs or workplaces or wherever, and we have to say, this is the clear alternative that can remedy the problems that face you now. This is precisely how a society of production solely for use will eradicate the problems of a society of production for sale and profit. This is how we can do it. This is how we can build houses for people to live in. This is how we can organise the workplace without wage slavery. This is how we can operate society without the fetter and the waste of the monetary system. That's what we have to do. Now, the Socialist Workers' Party is a leadership party. It is a vanguard. It is a group of nouveau Bolsheviks, latter-day Leninists. They're proud of the fact their entire principles are the principles of Leninism. And if you look at the Leninist revolutionary scenario, it's a very simple one. The workers follow the vanguard to socialism. Why do the workers follow the vanguard? Very simple. Because according to Lenin, embodied in the whole principle of Leninism, which my opponent must defend, workers cannot on their own understand the case for socialism. This is the position of Lenin. I quote from what he said in 1918 at the Peasant Soviet Congress in Russia. He said, if socialism can only be realized when the intellectual development of the people permits it, then we shall not see socialism for at least 500 years. The socialist political party, which is the vanguard of the working class, must not allow itself to be halted by the lack of education of the mass average, but must lead the masses. Now, I don't know whether this is the view of my opponent, but it's the view of his party. It's the basic argument of Leninism in relation to social transformation. The way you change society is based fundamentally upon the assumption that the majority of workers cannot think out the solution for themselves, but must be led into this. This was a position stated more than explicitly by Lenin in What Is to Be Done. Now, we in the Socialist Party argue very clearly that socialism will not be established unless socialists establish it. Socialists will not establish it unless a majority of workers understand and want it. And we argue that a majority of workers can understand. That if we can understand, they can understand. If we can desire production for use as an alternative, they can see the benefits as well. Unlike the Socialist Workers' Party, we don't hold with the quite unhistorical and outdated idea that revolution has to be by an enlightened and conscious minority leading an unconscious majority. But if you look in the literature of the Socialist Workers' Party, you find precisely that argument, completely contrary to the position put forward by Marx and by the First International in 1864, that the emancipation of the working class must be the work of the working class itself. That was Marx's position. And we don't accept it because it was Marx's position. We accept it because it is the correct position. Because you cannot impose liberation. You cannot lead people into liberation. You cannot have a liberated society in which the mass of the people are followers. You can only have socialism on the basis of democracy and on the basis of mass understanding. So let me summarise a case which I've argued. Firstly, I've argued that socialists have to have an understanding of capitalism. And I have defined what capitalism is. And they have to have a clear socialist alternative that they can put to workers in their literature and at their meetings and in the workplace and wherever. And I have defined quite clearly what we see as a socialist alternative. And secondly, I stated that my opponent's party spreads illusions about what can be done within capitalism. And that these illusions are both time-wasting and they are destructive of working class hope and enthusiasm. And thirdly, I pointed out that there has been an absence of any kind of clarity for my opponent's party about what socialism really means. And I put it to you that if you understand what capitalism really means, if you understand what the wages system is doing to you, if you understand the inevitability of legalized robbery under the wages system, if you understand the inevitability of workers being trodden into the ground by the dictates of profit, then you will understand the inevitability of there being only one alternative course to capitalism. And that is the one based upon conscious, majority-based political action on a democratic basis for socialist revolution. There is no alternative. And I conclude by putting this point to my opponent because it is vitally important. I began by referring to 1887, a magnificent strike. Thousands of passionate men and women of the working class. Dedication, enthusiasm, cooperation, mass organisation all over the country. Men and women trying to fight for this aim of bringing dignity for the miners. In 1984, 85, history has repeated itself at the mischievous expense of the working class. And unless the urgency is grasped of the struggle for the abolition of the wages system, unless capitalism is understood, unless the socialist alternative is put with clarity and enthusiasm, unless we can show that workers have the strength to go beyond the petty victories of the struggle for the crumbs, unless we can show that, then in 100 years' time, we could still be facing the same defeats, the same wasted enthusiasm, the same energies and disillusion following their expenditure. And that is why it is not as urgent today as it was in 1887 for us to organise for socialist revolution. It is far more urgent.